on with the show. As many of y'all have seen in some of the pre-show advertisements, for lack of a better phrase, our guest today, we're going to kind of cover a pretty broad spectrum of his experience in service to his country. A lot of people in active duty wonder, you know, what's going to happen if you spend a few decades in uniform and you hang up that uniform, but you still have a desire to serve. You still want to be in the game and contribute what you've invested most of your life in. And his background kind of lends that as somebody who has been able to do that and do that well. And we're going to talk a little bit about how he found that path to where he was going and what are perhaps some of the ideas that he has for others that may be mid-career who are thinking about that's not a bad way to make it happen going forward. And then we're going to branch out. We're going to talk about where we are right now as a Navy and Marine Corps team. What are some of the ideas, concepts, and capabilities that we have right now or just coming into the fleet that are good? And as we go through a period of transition in an age of austerity, what are those things we need to make sure that we keep our expertise at, that we invest what we need to invest in, intellectually think about them so that we're ready to perform when needed? And what are those items that perhaps we've gotten used to over the course of years or decades that are best left to the side if you had to choose between one or another? And our guest to discuss this and more is Robert O. Wirt, Colonel, United States Marine Corps, retired. He is presently the CEO for the Center for New American Security and most recently was the Undersecretary of the Navy from 2009 to 2013. He spent 27 years on active duty with the Marine Corps, and then he worked for a while over at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, where he focused on defense strategy and programs, revolutions in war, Department of Defense, Transportation, and Maritime Affairs. He also contributed to the DoD studies on global basing and emerging military missions, providing support to the 2006 QDR. During this time, he was also an adjunct professor over at George Washington University, where he taught defense analysis, roles and missions of the armed forces, and that teed him up really well when in late 2008, he brought on board again to serve with President Obama's Department of Defense transition team. Former Undersecretary Wirt, welcome to MIDRAF.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here. And please, just call me Bob.
Bob it is. I really appreciate the opportunity this afternoon. And I want to kind of do a little bit of a scene setter because when you a lot of people, for obvious reasons, people who had been well-read may have been familiar when you're over at CBSA, but when you came in as under, people would look at your background and say, hey, this, you know, good bull colonel, 27 years in the Marine Corps, did some stuff over on the think tank and academic side of the house, and got invited to a very important job with the transition team for a new administration, and then as the Undersecretary of the Navy. And there are a lot of people who are interested in how somebody does that. And just as kind of a personal backgrounder, personally, how did you kind of set the stage to prepare yourself for taking advantage of that opportunity when it presented itself? And if there are those junior or mid-grade officers who would want to kind of start to build that foundation, if that's a path they wanted to take in 10 or 15 years, what's a couple of things they should keep in mind that maybe you wish somebody had dropped in your ear when you're at their stage?
Well, when I was commissioned in 1974 as a second lieutenant, you know, I didn't have any idea that I would ultimately end up as the undersecretary, and wasn't making any conscious decisions along the way to get me there. Say the first 22 years of my career, you know, I considered myself a Marine first, a MAGTAF, a Marine Air Ground Task Force officer second, and an artilleryman third. And I pretty much had a typical career with possibly two exceptions. One is I always believed strongly in the Navy Marine Corps team. My first James Fighting Ships I purchased in Taiwan, and I have to admit it was probably a black market copy. And, you know, I followed both Navy issues as well as Marine issues throughout the first 22 years, and I'm not certain everyone does that, but I would certainly urge both Navy officers to think a lot about the Marine Corps and Marine officers to think a lot about the Navy. 1996 to 1998, I was the head of the Strategic Initiatives Group for a pretty remarkable general officer, Jim Jones, who will later become the National Security Advisor. And during that time frame, the relationship between the Navy and the Marine Corps, I think both of you probably remember this, it was quite striking to me that the I didn't think the department was really firing on all cylinders, primarily because of the problems that were cropping up between the two services. I went off to Command Camp Fuji and was asked by Richard Danzig, who was the 72nd Secretary of the Navy, to come back to be his MA. And that really kind of changed my mind and opened my aperture to where I said, you know, the nexus of strategy, programming, budget, and politics was really a fascinating one. And working under Richard Danzig for 2 years alongside Jim Stavridis, who later became both the commander of SOCOM and the commander of UCOM, that 2 years really changed my mind. And I know it's probably blasphemy to Marines, but I started thinking in terms of being a departmentalist first and a Marine second and a MAGTF officer third. When I got out, I really wanted to kind of approach my post career in that way. And I was lucky enough to land at CSBA and be able to write an awful lot about maritime affairs, both the Navy and the Marine Corps. And teaching at GW allowed me to really think about defense analysis and the roles and missions of the armed forces. As a lot of these things happened, it was just dumb luck. I was asked by Michelle Flournoy, who I knew, she was at the Center for New American Security when I was at CSBA. She was the co-lead of the transition team, and she just asked me if I would come over and help her out, which I did. And as a result of my time on the transition team, I was invited to be the under. So I just feel it was a matter of luck. I do feel my career kind of prepared me for the job. And for those of you who kind of aspire to that, I really would say you have to have a departmentalist aspect. You have to appreciate all the capabilities and capacities that the Navy Marine Corps team bring to the nation. You should need to think about it and write about it so that people understand your views, and then seize the opportunity when it arises.
As part of your work as both as Undersecretary and in these other positions you've held, you've been taking a look, I know, at innovation for our fleet and in a time of austerity. Could you talk a little bit about what that means and where you're looking, how you look down the future for the fleet 10, 15, 20 years out?
Yeah, it's a great question and one that really consumed a lot of my time as the undersecretary trying to think about it. Now, as the undersecretary, as the chief operating officer, you really kind of hold down, you know, you're really deep into the programmatics and the budgeting. So the amount of time you can really think about these broader issues is really quite limited. But it worried me a lot that we just didn't have the slack, in my view, to really innovate in a broad way in a period of when we all knew that the budget was coming down. Essentially, if you think about this, Secretary Gates knew that the defense budget was going to come down after we started to pull out of Iraq and Afghanistan. And he started trying to prepare the department for this. In 2009, in the QDR, the Quadrennial Defense Review, essentially the way he started it was he said, look, we're not going to be able to keep these exquisite weapon systems. We need to free up more slack. We need to free up more money so that we can innovate and pursue other things. And that was when he truncated the F-22. He canceled the Future Combat System. You know, very around that time frame, Admiral Ruffhead, then the Chief of Naval Operations, truncated the DDG-1000. And a year later, the Expeditionary Fighting Vehicle was canceled. So the first kind of stage on getting ready was, okay, we have to free up some budget slack because we're going to have this downturn, and we can't have these exquisite weapon systems kind of consuming everything that's left. Next year, he was very explicit. He said, look, we're going to tip over at FY15. He actually was wrong. It tipped over a lot sooner. But he said by FY15, we're not going to be getting any real growth in the defense budget, or we might have real declines. You have to have 2 to 3% real growth each year to maintain the force structure we had. So that year, we really focused on being more efficient. Then came the Budget Control Act in 2011, and that was the first $487 billion over 10 years. And it was front-loaded in the future year's defense plan. And so in that first 3 years, the innovation was as we could do it, but everything was really focused on just trying to manage the downturn. Now, a lot of people don't know this, but the high point was actually FY 2008. That's when we had about a $180 billion overseas contingency operation, OCO budget. So we're 5 years into this drawdown. A lot of people think that it tipped over in 10, but I really believe that the peak happened in 2008 in inflation-adjusted dollars. So we know we're coming down. We know we have a lot of national security challenges, and we really have to start innovating and figuring out what of these challenges, how we're going to approach them differently. And the thing that's keeping us, in addition, it's not just money. It's that we spend so much time shaping the international environment. And that's something the department is doing almost full-time since 1993. If you look at the interwar period when there wasn't a lot of money, there was this virtuous cycle of education, then a fleet exercise, then you would go back. And a lot of the learning and education occurred inside that cycle. We simply don't have the slack right now to do it. And if we have any hope of innovating in a broad way, we need to somehow free up some slack so we can do it.
And, Bob, we have a caller there on the line with a question. Claude, you're on the air with Bob.
Thanks. Mr. Work, thanks for taking the time this afternoon to be on MidRats.
Yes.
My question is based on my time teaching at the Naval Academy and looking out onto the midshipmen every day. In the next 20 or 30 years, we're going to see a significant reduction in the number of surface platforms, but especially a move from manned to unmanned aerial vehicles. And I guess the same is true for Air Force in terms of their air platforms. I wonder if there's a consequence to this in terms of naval education and specifically officer accession programs. In the next 20 or 30 years, sir, are we going to have to revisit how we do accession programs? Because right now we seem to have an infrastructure that's built around, you know, we graduate something like 1,100 Navy and Marine Corps officers every year from the Naval Academy. Are we going to have to look at that again in terms of cost effectiveness or whatever reasons may come down the pike? And stand by for your question, sir. Thank you very much.
Claude, it's a great question, and I'll unpack it because there's two very, very important things in this. Over the next, let's not argue about the time frame. It might happen in two decades. It might happen in three. But it seems to me that we're all of the services are moving inexorably towards a future in which unmanned systems are going to be more prominent in all operational domains. And there's a couple reasons for that. The first one is that the guided munitions regime is maturing. And both the technologies for guided munitions and battle networks are now pretty much widely available, and there's a military technical competition. We have had an advantage in this regime for the last two decades, we had a monopoly for the longest time, and that monopoly is now starting to erode. There's a vibrant military technical competition in the Western Pacific. There's one in the Gulf. There's one in the Eastern Mediterranean. And so when you move to guided munitions where your adversary can throw dense salvos of guided munitions, all aspects, whether you're doing coin operations, counterinsurgency operations, when the adversary has guided munitions, such as the Mujahideen in the 1980s when they were given stingers, or Hezbollah, the way they used AT-5 and AT-14 anti-tank weapons and rudimentary battle networks to surprise the Israelis, or against state adversaries, all of our power projection operations are going to be more lethal. So you have that trend. In my view, you can't argue the trend. The second trend is that people are the most expensive thing in our armed services right now, and personnel costs continue to rise. All of the service chiefs and the secretary have said, we've got to get a handle on this. It's very difficult. There's a lot of structural reasons why. It's not as easy as it sounds. So it's getting more dangerous on the battlefield. People are getting more expensive. And right now, our weapon systems are getting more sophisticated to deal with the guided munitions regime, and they're becoming more expensive. So on top of that, your budget is coming down, which in my view means in the 20s, we're definitely going to have smaller services, whether we like it or not. And the only way that you can build mass back up is through unmanned systems. And mass will become important when the bad guy has guided munitions as good as you. So you've got this, in my view, inexorable move towards what Wayne Hughes out at the Naval Postgraduate School calls the move to the age of robotics. And that is going to require our education program, which is the second part of your very insightful question, to change. You know, what type of officers do we need to, create and nurture and mentor and train and educate to operate in an age in which unmanned systems are no longer just adjuncts of manned systems, but unmanned systems are actually a major bulk portion of either your fleet or your Air Force or your ground combat systems? How do we teach them to create these swarming tactics? How do we teach them and train them to control large numbers of unmanned systems? So to me, Jerry Hendricks, who's the current head of the Naval History and Heritage Command, he has this idea of the Navy knowledge enterprise, which includes all of our, the Naval Postgraduate School, the Naval War College, the Naval Academy, the way we teach our ROTC officers. We have to think of this Navy knowledge enterprise in a holistic manner, and we have to start making the choices, I think, over the next couple years, maybe the next 5 years or so. How do we structure this Navy knowledge enterprise so that we create the future, or we're prepared for the future that we can dimly see coming? So a very good question, and one that I think is going to require a lot more thinking.
One question we have asked a couple of our guests about, and looking forward, history is always changing. Page after page at a page, only thing constant is change. But occasionally, history doesn't just turn a page; it opens up a new chapter. And a couple of those chapters we saw after World War II in 1947, we had the National Security Act, and that kind of gave us the broad structural outlines until, kind of at the height of the last phase of the Cold War in 86, we got Goldwater-Nichols 27 years ago, and which, changed the way the service chiefs operated, how the combatant commanders assigned. And as we're going through perhaps another chapter, we'll know for sure if it was a chapter or a page here in a few years looking back on it. But where we are right now, coming up on 2014, right in the middle of the second decade of the 21st century, does Goldwater-Nichols really serve our needs? And are there some things in Goldwater-Nichols that you've seen inside D.C. that are working really well, and if we do adjust things and move it, we need to make sure and keep? And are there some things that were done with Goldwater-Nichols that maybe aren't the most optimum way for us to do the broad picture organization of the services?
Well, another great question. First of all, I'd like to go back to the very early part, and I think a lot of people think of this next 4 or 5 years of the period we're going through kind of like the 90s, where we were, you know, trying to figure out what our global operating model would be after the Cold War. I think you hit the nail on the head. When this, I really believe this is much more like 1947 through 1953-54, when all of the old kind of rules of doing business and all of the, you know, the assumptions that had built up over time were suddenly all kind of slipped from their moorings. And we had to really look at all sorts of things, the organization of the Department of Defense, the roles and missions of the armed services. We had to make big technological choices. So I really believe that this time, this period right now, is much more like this, like that time. And, you know, trying to position ourselves for the 21st century and how we're going to get ready for it. Now, unquestionably, Goldwater Nichols, that was the end of a long, long period that started, you know, in 1953, actually before that, 1947, to try to get unified action of the armed forces. There was a broad feeling among the upper echelons, primarily led by Dwight D. Eisenhower, that although we did extremely well in World War II, that it would behoove us to be better at having unified action of the armed forces. The 1947 National Security Act that you talked about was one of the first stages, and Eisenhower took two swings at this, both the one in 1953 and one in 1957, and all of the changes were really to strengthen the combatant commander and to force us towards unified action of the armed forces. When he left office in 1960, he was very, very disillusioned in how far he had gotten. And I think his disillusionment was kind of brought home in some of the problems we had in Vietnam in terms of command and control. Then came the Mayaguez incident. Then came Desert One, the hostage rescue. Then came Grenada. And it just became clear to Congress that, look, if you're going to get unified action of the armed forces, the Congress would have to step in. And in my view, in the broadest sense, it was a great success. I mean, I think if you view U.S. military operations at the campaign level now, there's just no comparison to some of the problems that we saw. We're not perfect by any means, but a big, big, big improvement. The one area that I think we have to consider is Goldwater Nichols was designed to make the COCOMs, the combatant commanders, much more effective in combat. But what happened in practice is after the end of the Cold War, it really made them the primary kind of voice in shaping operations, which had an inexorable pull of all of the focus of the department. The request for forces that the COCOMs make are just unbelievable. They're relentless. And in the 4 years that I was the undersecretary, I would just, quite frankly, sometimes I would just shake my head and say, what are we trying to accomplish with this particular thing? An example I can give you is one time we were requested to have a ship off of Colombia while the president was there to show our maritime cooperation with Colombia. Well, the right ship to send was a frigate. But we wound up sending a Ticonderoga-class cruiser with a MH-60R helicopter. Those are the kind of things that I always scratch my head on. And the second perverse effect is that, of course, the service chiefs have a very 2 to 3 year kind of time horizon where the service chiefs are trying to develop a force by looking out 20 years. And I think we have to bring that back into balance. The Goldwater Nichols was extraordinarily successful in fixing the operational part of the problem. But right now, especially in a period of austerity, the service chiefs really should be the strongest voice, in my view, on what the future of their services should be. And right now, I believe it's a little disproportionately skewed towards the kind of here and now and the shaping. That's the one thing that I think that we should think about in the Goldwater-Nichols and say, how might we make that a little bit better?
Well, speaking of force shaping and stuff like that, the DDG 1000 Zumwalt class and the weapon systems that it is supposed to bring online, the energy, the rail guns and all that stuff. Admiral Greener's talking about payloads over platforms. How do we bring the technology of the DDG 1000 class into this payloads versus platform scenario that Admiral Greener is painting?
Well, it's an interesting thing. I was in, as I said, I was Richard Danzig's military assistant during the time that the DDG 1000 requirements were being made. And I have to tell you, a lot of the focus was on stealth, but the two things that Richard Danzig convinced me were the most important things in that shift were, one, the automation that would allow you to have smaller crews and make them really, really effective. And the second thing was the integrated power system going to electric drive. Those were the two things that he said, look, no matter what happens, you know, the radar might change. You might get a 155, you know, advanced gun system first. It might someday become an electromagnetic system. But the two things we know, again, going back, people cost a lot. You've got to design ships with small crews, and it's got to be done in a smart way or you can't fight the ship effectively. And I think we see that a lot in some of the early LCS experiments. You know, it doesn't matter whether it's a small ship or a 14,000-ton battle cruiser. You've really got to get that the size of the crew right. So the two things, in my view, are this automation and then the integrated power system. Once you get the integrated power system right, then you open up entire new avenues for electric weapons, both directed energy and electromagnetic railguns. Now, the reason why those two are extremely important are, again, this maturation of the guided munitions battle network regime. When you used to fight with unguided weapons, you would have to mass an enormous number of platforms or weapons to fire salvos that were dense enough to statistically assure yourself that you'd actually hit the target. I was an artilleryman. I used to use the JMIMS manual all the time, the Joint Munitions Effects Manual. And it would say, hey, if you were firing at a pillbox, you might have to fire a battery 10. What that would mean, I'd have a six-gun battery, and I'd have to fire 60 rounds just to ensure one target hit to achieve destruction of the target. If I wanted to neutralize, I would maybe fire, you know, a battery 6. And if I just wanted to suppress, maybe I'd fire a battery 2. But if you take a look in the unguided munitions warfare regime, you have these huge salvos. In the guided munitions regime, you only have to fire a salvo that's big enough to saturate the defense, because any given leaker is probably going to hit the target and achieve effects. It puts an enormous burden on the defense, because guided munitions warfare is offensive dominant. That's why Wayne PU says fire first effectively. It's really what you have to do, because, you know, defenses are at a disadvantage. Naval defenses are at a double disadvantage because their magazine size simply can't compare with a land-based magazine. Once you get to electric weapons, though, everything changes. You have a very dense and deep magazine, and you are able to fire and defeat pretty dense salvos. That gives your fleet an enormous it opens up new avenues of maneuver at sea that you simply don't have right now. So getting a small crew size, getting the integrated power systems, I would say that in the 2020s, the replacement for the DDG-51, without question, is going to have an integrated power system, and we're going to have experimented with directed energy weapons and electromagnetic weapons, and those will be the payloads that we really start to put on the ship. The other part of this is the unmanned systems revolution. I think of the LCS. I know there's a lot of detractors, but the way that ship is designed, it is designed primarily as a platform for unmanned systems. It has an air and sea interface to be able to employ a lot of them. I think of the LCS as the USS Langley, which is, most of the listeners know, was the first aircraft carrier. And they are designed to teach us how can we employ unmanned systems in a tactically and operationally useful way. In my view, the LCS, that's the big value of that ship. So I think unmanned systems, electric weapons, smaller crews, those are going to be the payloads of the future that really, really may take our Navy and our Marine Corps team into the 21st century.
And we have another caller on the line. Jerry, you are on the line with Bob.
Thank you, Mr. Work, for the call out earlier. This is Jerry Hendricks calling in. You've served up so much material here that's worthy of discussion, but I wanted to argue a point with you, and that is that you were talking that you thought that the 1940s and the post-war period is perhaps an era that would instruct us today. And although I see much good in looking at Eisenhower's new look environment as well as the Solarium project for creating new strategies, I actually think that the 90s are the right time to look at. And by that I mean the 1890s, when you had such a, not an evolutionary leap forward in technology, but a revolutionary leap forward in the advent of steam and electricity and a number of different technologies that were introduced all at once. And we have the squadron of evolution and the creation of new industries within the United States, and not to mention a lot of challenges within the officer corps of integrating these new sciences and engineering into the running of our Navy and our ships. And so as we look at the challenges today, we really need almost someone who can step forward and conceptualize what we were able to accomplish in the 1890s, and then almost as quickly what we did in the 1920s and 1930s with the era of experimentation and fleet exercises. And I completely sympathize and agree with your point that we don't have enough slack in order to do this experimentation and find a way of figuring out what to do with what we have now and what we have coming. But what do you think of the 1890s analogy?
I would never, Jerry, debate you on historical points, but I think you have a very good one. What's happening, everybody likes to talk about revolutions and military affairs and revolutions this, revolutions and that. And I think the right way to think about it is the next couple decades is going to be a period of potential discontinuous change. And in these military technical revolutions, and the one that you talked about in the 1890s, the ones that are most interesting and the ones that have the most kind of broadest kind of change are things that are kind of led by the commercial sector. And a lot of the stuff that was going on in the 1890s, the advent of steam power, the advent of the radio, the advent of smaller combustion, internal combustion engines, and diesels, and diesel electric. All of these things had vast and big commercial impacts. Now, if you compare that since 1940, and this, I guess I should disconnect it and say, I see the strategic landscape in the 1947s and 1953 that is most applicable. But I think you maybe have a good point on the technology. Because if you think about it, in the 1950s, what was driving us forward? It was all a lot of military inventions. It was the changeover from our turboprops to jets. It was the creation of nuclear-powered submarines. Then came space, military space and civilian space. But the militarization of space was a big, big technology driver. Then in the 1960s came more tin cap, the tactical exploitation and national capabilities. Then came stealth, then came precision. A lot of things were being driven by the military. But the commercial things that are happening now, the advances in computing, big data, increases in artificial intelligence and autonomy, advances in robotics, advances in miniaturization, all of these things are really being drawn forward on the commercial sector. And just like the 1890s, you have both huge societal impacts as well as military impacts. So this goes back to our question on education. How do we train and educate our officers in both the Navy and the Marine Corps to take a look at this rich milieu of just enormous technological flux that's going to be happening over the next two decades? And how do you train people like those in the 1930s who said, you know, this is how we have to deal with the airplane. This is how we get greater range. This is how we adopt dive bombing tactics. This is how we utilize sonar and radar and move it into an era where we can operationalize it. You know, getting a new generation of officers who think about this in a coherent way is just going to be absolutely essential. So I actually quite like your 1890s analogy, Jerry, because I believe most of those innovations were being driven by the commercial sector as they are now, whereas most of the technology innovations in the 50s, 60s, and 70s were being driven by the military. So I think you're on to something.
Well, thank you, and I look forward to listening to the rest of the show.
As always, thanks a lot, Jerry, for coming on. And you know, going from the 1890s to maybe the late 1990s, one thing that we've seen happen, and you know, no program gets developed in a couple of years, so there's always a decade or two to work a program up. And what we've seen in the last 15 years are the death of some programs that showed great promise, billions of dollars, lots of really sharp people investing a lot of time. You know, you look at the Army side of the equation, the Crusader self-propelled gun, the Comanche attack reconnaissance helicopter. You know, the Air Force, you could also look at the F-22, and on the Navy side, you know, you brought the DDG-1000. And you know, the F-22 and the DDG-1000 were kind of failed to thrive. Is they never really fleshed out as much as they were for a variety of reasons. But what they share with the Crusader and the Comanche as well is inside those programs, there were some great capabilities and some good technology. You know, you mentioned, only a Navy guy can say that something like this is sexy, but the sexy part of DDG-1000 is electrical generation capability and how we can leverage that technology in the future. But it kind of begs the question, is there a common thread in these high-profile, high-expenditure programs that either died in the womb or failed to thrive that we need to look at in our ability to perhaps better manage program risk and technology risk so when we come up to the mid-20s and have DDGX and perhaps the smaller combatant follow on to LCS, whether it's 24 or 50-some-odd that we build, are there some things that we need to think about to better manage our programs in integrating technology into new systems?
Wow, that's another great question and one of the toughest problems that face anyone who goes into the Department of Defense. You know, in my view, you have these two poles. You have the one pole in which you want to really push fast and get a transformative system. And what you do then is you just ask for an awful lot of requirements in a single platform. And in almost every case, you can't integrate. It's not so much the technologies, although the technologies themselves are sometimes quite challenging. It's the integration of all of the technologies that really slow things down and really spread out the development of the system. So that's on one end of the pole. On the other end of the pole was where we tried in the early 90s what was then called spiral development, and you were just going to make this kind of truck. And then you were going to, you know, what you would do is you would constantly change it over time. We have to be better in getting a spot in the middle where we're getting really good capabilities much faster than we do now, but not ask for so much in the first platform. Perfect example for this for the Navy is the Ford-class carrier. The original Navy plan was to spread in the technological load on the carriers over three hulls. But the Department of Defense said, no, you know, we want to move for a transformational type platform. So we put all of the stuff, the electromagnetic launching system, to replace steam catapults, you know, the advanced arresting gear, a dual band radar. I mean, you just started pushing all of this stuff into it. And what happens is, you know, technical risk goes up, your schedule slips, costs go up, you can't move it in as fast as you want. Then on the other side is the LCS, which was really designed with the spiral technology in mind. But you really have to be, you have to have a very disciplined spiral technology system, because otherwise you get out of sync. So I think we do have to be better at managing technological risk. And one of the things is to really make sure you understand the cost of the requirements that you need on the first system. And the second thing is you have to maintain continuity as best you can. Having program managers who stay with the program for 4 to 5 years, and really trying to manage it as we go along. I think, you know, with unmanned systems, it's going to be look much more like the 1930s in aviation. Holy crap, I mean, you know, it seemed like every other week you were coming out with an advance in either range or speed or payload. And the Navy was just, you know, they would experiment with a couple different types of designs, and they'd jettison those, and they'd go right into another one. I think the unmanned robotics age, you're going to see much more of that. You're going to be able to have really tighter development lines, and with additive manufacturing, you're going to be able to go to smaller production runs without breaking the bank, and then quickly shifting to another design. So, you can be either a glass-half-full type of guy or a glass-half-empty. I'm definitely a glass half full. This next 10 years is going to be something as we kind of shift over towards this unmanned future, and you're just going to have a lot of experimentation on a wide variety of fronts, and maybe that's how we get to better risk management.
Well, one of the questions I have, I guess, about all that is that we've seemed to have gone to these extremely expensive large ships, and even the LCS, I don't want to get into the LCS thing, but other than the fact that they cost a lot of money, is there a place in our Navy for inexpensive, show the flag, smaller ships, give young officers command early, to do things that don't require a billion-dollar-plus Aegis cruiser, like counter-piracy and small show the flag missions? Sort of like Jerry Hendricks' influence squadrons. Yeah. Influence squadrons.
Well, here's the deal. I mean, I actually believe that, you know, having smaller ships to do these types of missions is a very, very good thing. But the thing that I just don't think that most of the people who argue for small ships think about is the problem of overseas basing. To go to small ships, you simply cannot, in my view, have them sitting in San Diego and Norfolk with a large fleet of heavy lift carriers that are going to take them to the theater when needed. They've got to be in the theater that they're going to operate in. They generally have shorter endurance than the larger platforms. And the smaller you get, the less endurance they have, and the more support they need. And here's where it all breaks down. It is an unnatural act for foreign nations to allow U.S. forces to be based in their country. I think about this all the time because I did a big study for Mr. Marshall about global basing postures. And in 1942, the United States started thinking about what they wanted to have their basing posture after they won the war. They assumed in 42 we were going to win. They said, okay, how are we going to maintain the peace? We're going to need to have U.S. forces based abroad. This is quite unnatural for the United States, but that's what we were thinking. And we pretty much by 1944, 1945, said, well, wherever we end up, we're going to be able to request presence and we'll get it. And that just didn't happen. Even though we saved these many of these nations from either Japanese or German occupation. By 1946, there was only one country in the world who had granted basing rights to the United States. Do you have any idea which country it was? Brazil. None of the other nations said, okay, let's happen. And that's what we face with right now. I mean, the number of bases overseas are starting to come down. The U.S. Army will have two brigades in Europe, a brigade combat team in Germany, a striker brigade, as well as an airborne brigade in Italy. We'll have a brigade on the ground in Korea. We'll have the Marine Expeditionary Force in Japan. But almost everywhere else, what people want are rotational presence forces, not based forces. And then, somebody says, hey, well, let's have all these missile flotillas out in the Western Pacific. Okay, where are you going to base them? That is going to be viewed as provocative by the Chinese. The Chinese will have something to say to the neighbors who allow these ships to go to be there. The same thing with diesel submarines. So the reason why the LCS was built and was built with the broad consensus of the surface warfare community, they brought in 200 operators in the LCS Characteristics Task Force, and they said, look, we want this ship to have forward presence, but the number one thing that you must have for a forward presence ship is a ship that is self-deployable. That was the number one thing, which is why the LCS is a little bit bigger than, say, the Ambassador II missile corvette. It was made so it could be self-deploy and then operate in the theater. So it's this constant tug and pull between basing operations and forward deployed operations and the size of the ship. And I just don't think people who say, let's go after these very small missile corvettes and these very small ships that have 8 days of endurance, how are you going to deploy them and base them overseas? Until I hear that, then ships about the size of the LCS, in my view, are exactly what you want. A ship that has helicopter capability, is self-deployable, has useful capacity for unmanned systems. Man, that's a pretty darn good ship, in my view, for the future. Now, I know a lot of people have a lot of different views on this, but I believe in the influence squadrons, and I think a combination of LCSs, joint high-speed vessels in some places, like where we have bases in the Gulf, like in Bahrain. Having smaller ships there is great. Being able to forward deploy ships like the LCS in Singapore is great. But getting smaller ships, that really starts to be problematic because of the logistics that the host nation would have to approve. And that becomes problematic.
No, I can't agree with you more than that. I think, the tyranny of distance and the mathematics of range, it's pretty firm, especially when you're dealing with the Pacific. And one of my favorite examples is, the difference between our pre-World War II fleet submarines and the German Type 7. If the Germans had fleet submarines like we had, as opposed to their Type 7 at the beginning of the war, Operation Drumbeat would have been even more difficult than it was. And it does kind of tie into a question I want to kind of roll your way. I kind of generally talk about it as the unsexy but important is you have they're almost, except for the submarine tenders are gone, but tenders, unrep ships, the smaller amphibious ships, MLPs, AFSBs, those types of ships that maybe aren't as sexy looking as an LCS-2 or the new catapults on the Ford class carriers, but especially to forward deployed, to go to the opposite parts of the earth on an Indo-Pac and to be able to create effects and do what you need to do on other parts, you need that type of range and that type of ability to sustain yourself away from a nice comfortable home port. Have we done enough to in this time of austerity, to make sure that those aren't the items that are left on the cutting room floor. On the aviation side, you have the C2 replacement. And or do we have the right people in influence positions to make sure that the unsexy but important doesn't get lost in this crunch so we can do what we may need to do in the Indo-Pac area?
Man, you're singing a song that really resonates with me. I'd add one other word to your unsexy, important, and that's adaptable. I think Richard Danzig, for the readers who haven't seen it, he wrote a really nice exposition on prediction. And he said, look, we're always wrong. We're not going to predict. Don't waste your time on that. What you really want are platforms that are adaptable, because we're almost always going to get it wrong. And that's what CNO Greenert, I think, has just got it right on. If you have adaptable platforms that are, even if they're unsexy and don't look all that great, a mobile landing platform, an advanced forward staging base, a joint high-speed vessel, LCS, your amphibs, all of these things are just big adaptable capability containers. And it doesn't matter whether you put in humanitarian assistant disaster relief payloads, or if you put in mines, or if you put in missiles, or you put in special operations forces, or if you put in Marines, excuse me. I mean, all of these things, they're not a high-speed Virginia, you know, they're not a Virginia-class attack submarine, which is peerless. You know, but they are big capability containers. Some of them have gray hulls. Some of them have black hulls. And I think the Navy in the next 5 to 10 years can really start to experiment with this. Once we get the MLP out there, that's a perfect base for Jerry Hendricks' influence squadron. You can put a couple PCs, you know, patrol coastal class, on them and take them out to theater, and that could serve as a mobile base. Joint high-speed vessels can tie up with them. You can airlift in different payloads that you can put on the joint high-speed vessel. You might even airlift in LCS payloads that you might be able to swap out at sea. You've got the afloat forward staging bases that have an enormous capacity and capability to do these type things. Look, this is a naval century, in my view. There's all sorts of different things that the Navy can do to where we can have different packets of very capable naval capabilities and capacities distributed around the world that are quite important. Now, I've probably talked way too much about just the Navy, but let me give you a Marine Corps example. The Marine Corps Special Purpose MAGTAF, their Crisis Response Special Purpose MAGTAF, what that is a Marine Reinforced Rifle Company with 6 V-22s and 2 KC-130Js. They're sitting in Marone. You can take that rifle company really quickly over a large area, air refuelable, you know, relatively fast closure speeds. And a Marine rifle company in many of these crisis response capabilities is enormous capacity and capability for many of the response forces. And that's another thing I just need to emphasize. I started this off by saying I'm a big departmentalist. The Navy Marine Corps team is moving closer and closer, they're moving back together in a very healthy way. I think General Jim Amos, the Commandant of the Marine Corps, Admiral John Greenert, the Chief of Naval Operations, I think they both agree that the Navy Marine Corps team operating together is really, really an important asset for the nation. You can see all of the innovation that's going on in the Marine Corps. Unmanned logistics delivery with the K-MAX out in Afghanistan, different types of the special purpose MAGTAF crisis response. On the Navy side, all of these new platforms. The Navy and the Marine Corps agreeing, let's put different types of combinations of capacities and capabilities on these platforms. It's really an exciting time if we can free up the slack to allow our operational forces to experiment. This really could be another 1930s where we're seeing all sorts of new and different ways to command our forces and place them around the world.
You know, you all have been talking about a subject near and dear to my heart, being an old mobile logistics service force guy. all of which now is in the MSC. Our logistics sustainment force for our Navy is Military Sealift Command. And do they have the right mix of ships? Do we have the right numbers of ships? Is this an area where we should also be focusing on where to spend our defense dollars?
Well, the Military Sealift Command, especially the combat logistics forces, the naval auxiliary forces, those are the TAKEs and the ammunition ships and the oilers. They have got this down to a science. I mean, when you take a look at it, you know, each of those MSC ships are manned by, you know, essentially civilian contract mariners. And we get 270 days of operational availability out of each one of those platforms. So, you know, we're going to go to a force of about 29 ships, and it doesn't sound like a lot, but in peacetime, because of the extremely high availability, it can certainly manage and support our global operations. When you get to wartime, you say, you know, these are going to be extremely attractive targets. Are 29 enough? You know, it's a constant balance. It's really tough. But you're exactly right. This whole thing about distributed operations, the United States Navy and the United States Marine Corps, in my view, are peerless in the world in terms of distributed operations, both in command and control and the way they operate. You know, a Marine Expeditionary Unit goes out now, and the three ships in the unit are hardly ever together. You know, they blast apart, and the big deck goes one way, and the LPD-17 goes another, and the LSD goes another. When a carrier strike group goes to theater, generally the only thing next to the carrier is a combat shotgun. The rest of the destroyers are all over the place. You've got 10 to 12 submarines around the world all the time. So you have this globally dispersed force that can expand and contract extremely quickly, and the combat logistics force are the glue that makes it all run together. I think in the future I'd like to see more tenders. I'd like to see more submarine tenders so that we could rearm in theater if possible. You know, more AFSBs, float forward staging bases, more JHSVs. You know, it's all going to be tough because of the budget. But we can't forget logistics, because it's the thing that makes our global Navy Marine Corps team so remarkable and so different than any other Navy in the world, Navy Marine Corps team.
Bob, what an incredibly fast hour this has been. And I just wanted to roll it up a little bit, just kind of talk about the near term. Is over at CNAS, what do you have your team there focused on? You know, what are you investing your intellectual capital in over at CNAS? And also, I always like to know what people have on their must-read list. Are there a few books or authors out there that you have on your I need to read by New Year's list that the listeners might be interested in grabbing hold of to see what's going to be bouncing around in your head over the next few months?
Well, let me take this one at a time. You know, CNAS is going to have seven major research programs. One is going to be strategy and statecraft. That's going to be our seventh program. It starts up on the 2nd of January. And we're really looking about, you know, our new, you know, how should we change our global operating model, get to some of the changes in Golar Nichols that we talked about, trying to redress the balance between shaping and preparing for the future, what should be our grand strategy, things like that. There's two really big mega trends that we follow, and one of the programs is technology and national security. And it looks at the intersection of strategy, technology, and business, because, as I say, we see most of the technological pull coming from commercial sector, and we want to look at that nexus of strategy, technology, and business so that we have, you know, we haven't really talked about the industrial base. We talked a lot about teaching our officers, educating and training our officers. We got to have a very vibrant and adaptable industrial base also. Then the United States is going to be, you know, probably a net energy exporter here in the next decade or so. That has huge geopolitical ramifications. So our third program is energy, environment, security. and it looks at the national implications of these changing dynamic energy markets as well as the effects of climate change and what are the national security issues there. We have a responsible defense program that looks at everything that you can think of about the military, from the future of the Army to, you know, how we attack